to have you back, Ray, on this podcast.
Thank you, Nima. Thank you for inviting me.
And let's get started, Ray, with what's going on right now in the Middle East and the tensions between, the raising tensions between Israel and Hezbollah. And what's your understanding, what's your take on what's going on there, and how did you find it, this type of attack? We had this, the pager bombings, walkie-talkie bombings. Right after that, we had this bombing by fighter jets, and Netanyahu, right after all those, Netanyahu came out, sent a video message to Lebanese people in which he's trying to convince them that it's not us, it's Hezbollah that's killing you. Here is the clip. I'm going to play it for you.
Thanks.
Israel's war is not with you. It's with Hezbollah. For too long, Hezbollah has been using you as human shields. It placed rockets in your living rooms and missiles in your garage. Those rockets and missiles are aimed directly at our cities, directly at our citizens. To defend our people against Hezbollah strikes, we must take out those weapons. Now, starting this morning, the IDF has warned you to get out of harm's way. I urge you, take this warning seriously. Don't let Hezbollah endanger your lives and the lives of your loved ones. Don't let Hezbollah endanger Lebanon. Please, get out of harm's way now. Once our operation is finished, you can come back safely to your homes.
Ray, who's killing Lebanese people? Is Hezbollah or Israel?
Well, actually, it's Israel, as people well know. I just, you know, I'm thinking of echoes about Gaza. And UN Secretary General said yesterday that, my God, this looks like Gaza Part 2. My God. In other words, are the Israelis determined to level at least that part of Lebanon to the extent that they had just done Gaza? So the business about, okay, get to a safe place, get out of town here, we're for your own good, and you know, human shields and all that, and you're in your garage and in your living room, they're firing these rockets. I mean, would you buy a used car from that guy? I wouldn't. He's very persuasive, but I can't believe that any Palestinian or any Hezbollah or any Lebanese would believe him. This is all for public consumption, of course, and to try to repair some of the damage that is done to him in the public arena as he decides whether to go to the UN or whether not to go to the UN for his speech on Friday. I'm not up on the latest on that, but I noticed that he has postponed it twice. I would not be surprised at all if he justified not coming and not subjecting himself to the acrimony that he's bound to encounter, not coming at all. We'll see. I don't know. Maybe that has been decided.
Yeah. Ray, do you think that Biden, in the Biden administration, do you see any sort of sign that they're trying to put any sort of pressure on Netanyahu?
I believe that the military is. Now, the military is working through its counterparts, the IDF, the Israeli Defense so-called forces. And the IDF does not want to go into Lebanon full bore. They have not done real well in Gaza, to say it softly. They don't want a wider war. So our military has a natural ally there in the Israeli military. And we have had a couple of four-star generals visiting their counterparts in Tel Aviv and so forth. What have they been counseling? My view, or my best guess, is that they've been counseling restraint. For God's sake, don't bite off too much that you can chew. Don't expect us to advise Biden that we should come in and help you on the ground. Don't do that, because we're not going to advise Biden that. I don't know what Biden's going to do, but he'll do it despite our best advice, okay? And, you know, just this whole business about the Israeli military resisting this is real enough, it will remain to be seen whether our military will have enough persuasive power with Biden to restrain Netanyahu. Because clearly, what Netanyahu expects, what he is 95% sure of, is that in a 6-week period before the election here, Biden and Harris would have no alternative at all to going in full bore, including U.S. direct military support, if the IDF gets in trouble. The IDF knows it's going to get in trouble. So does the U.S. military. Will the U.S. military be powerful enough to dissuade Biden from doing a very foolish thing? The stakes are high, and this is a political decision, unfortunately, I have to say, because Biden is very, very aware of the Israel lobby and what it can do in the next 6 weeks. And so he has to appear at least as strong as Trump. And my God, Trump is 150% behind Netanyahu, as far as I can see. So there's a lot of money, there's a lot of votes at stake. And unlike Ukraine, where, as I can tell you later, the military seemed to have prevailed in a very interesting way and put the Blinkens of this world, referring to Ukraine, put them at bay and just overriding them. Now, Blinken is well described as Netanyahu's lawyer, right? And so the stakes politically are higher for the administration. Strategically, they're not as high. I mean, that's farther away than Ukraine. We have less commitment, so to speak, strategically, well, to defend Israel or anything. So I don't know how it's going to work out, but we do have some hope. My hope is that Netanyahu will not be able to persuade the IDF to go into Lebanon big time, as they did in 2006 and got many bloody noses. Okay, they had to withdraw. What makes them think they could prevail now? The only thing that possibly could convince them would be if they expect full-throated U.S. support. And that's why it's essential that Biden be advised that, you know, if you do this, this is escalation. They talk about, it's a good idea. We're going to escalate to de-escalate. Explain that to me, Nima. Explain that to me. Escalation by virtue of its... Escalation means more escalation. Okay, so this is not going to work. So what Netanyahu does now is going to be conditioned, in my view, by what he perceives to be the U.S. point of view and what Biden and Harris will feel it possible to do in 6 weeks before an election. And, you know, Netanyahu said in 2001, and it's on film, the Americans are always persuaded to do what we want them to do. They support us 80%. That's absurd. End quote. So spake Netanyahu on tape. We have the tape. It's on YouTube, okay? So maybe it's not 80% anymore. Maybe there are enough people with conscience in this country. It's only 50%. Whether he's take that risk? Well, I think he'd take that risk anyway, unless Biden is persuaded to call him up, or as he did with Stromer, say, no, we're not making an announcement to support you now. So that's my take. It's always been my take. And I just hope that our military is able to make the kind of impact that they were able to make, not only in Tel Aviv, or London, but in Washington, when Stormer, the British Prime Minister, came in, and our military overrode Blinken and told Biden, look, this is a really bad idea. Do not authorize longer range missile attacks deeper into Russia. And Biden, you could tell reluctantly, you could tell when he sat down and shouted at that question he got. So you could tell he was really kind of crestfallen, but he yielded. So let's cross our fingers and think maybe he'll yield again.
Yeah. We know that the new president of Iran is in New York, and he had an interview with CNN, and he was asked what would be the react, what would be the response of Iran in terms of the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh in Iran. Here is what he said to CNN.
The government of Israel would, of course, say that the reason they are retaliating against Hezbollah is Hezbollah has been raining rockets in northern Israel, has driven 60, 70,000 people out of their homes. These are men, women, and children. These are civilians. And that Israeli response is a response to that, those Hezbollah rocket attacks.
Do you believe that? In Gaza, the same Israel, how many people have they murdered? More than 41,000 people. What have they done to the Israelis for them to deserve to have their hospitals, their schools, men, women, children, old and young, targeted? How many Israelis were killed in response to which they have killed so many, tens of thousands? Did the children kill anyone? Did the women murder anyone? Is someone who's hospitalized murder anyone? Today at the United Nations, they were saying that 200 United Nations personnel were martyred in this, in that, on that land. So who believes really what Israel says now? If Hezbollah can muster the strength to even, let's assume, rain down thousands of rockets, how many people have they killed? Israel, on the other hand, they commit acts of terror. They go wherever they wish. They attack countries at will. They go wherever they wish and commit assassinations. They've done that for decades. And the greatest international government committing international acts of terror is Israel. Today, through their paramilitary and other organizational personnel, UAVs, aerial bombardments, they're committing these crimes every day. And on the night of my inauguration as the new president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, they came to our capital city and they martyred Ismail Haniyeh. Who does that? Now, these are terrorists, the ones who wish to only defend their land and their dignity and their country. You know, coming up with the appropriate and right numbers is not that big of an effort. Let's see how many have been victims of those who commit the actual terror and how many lives have been lost for defending one's dignity and territorial integrity. Who is it in this framework that has no value for humanity? And the world sees this, the world witnesses this, and the powers are defending this, the powers that are so-called defenders of human rights. This is embarrassing.
You have said that Iran reserves the right to respond in the time, manner, and place of its choosing to the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. Are you saying that you will for sure respond in some way to that assassination?
If international organizations cannot make this individual sit down and stand down, and they keep allowing someone who unfortunately has the means to commit such atrocities, then naturally we will give the appropriate response.
Yeah.
Wow.
Ray, your take.
President Pezeshkian, is that how he pronounces it?
Yeah, Pezeshkian.
Pezeshkian. There are several distinctive things about that. Number one, that Fareed Zakaria did not interrupt him after the first half minute. Well, he must have spoken about 7-8 minutes. And what he said, I really wonder whether that will be on the CNN film when it plays. I think it plays Sunday or something like that, right? I suppose it will. But that's a good indication that the Iranians, at least, are being given some attention for once. Now, his question, that is Fareed Zakaria saying, well, are you going to retaliate or not? And his answer was, well, if if international authorities can't hold these people accountable, what other choice do we have? Now, that strikes me as a principled position. In other words, the Iranians, like the Russians, I dare say, at least voice respect for international organizations like the UN, like other bodies, and they try there first, okay? And if that doesn't work, then they go to their next choice. What else? I guess I was just impressed by his poise. He's not a ranter, and what he didn't say, maybe he says this later in the interview, but Hezbollah is doing this precisely because of what's happening in Gaza. They've made that clear. You stop what you're doing in Gaza, Israel, we'll stop what we're doing up north here. The Hamas is Sunni, I think, right? And Hezbollah is Shia. I mean, my God, they used to be at loggerheads, right? They're united right now. So Israel has united Shia and Sunni in a way that I haven't perceived before. Iran, of course, is Shia. But there's a movement toward solidarity there. And I suppose the distinctive thing is the restraint with which they're approaching these problems. And I think it's more a question of discretion and of a firm belief that in the end, there are more of them than of Israelis, that the Israelis and their tutors and their sponsors are being disgraced before the rest of the world, the third world, and that if they just hang on there, if they lick their wounds and get their new communication set people or communications mechanisms set up, then, you know, we'll wait to see what happens. But the Israelis, I don't think, are going to make the terrible mistake of actually invading Lebanon the way they did before. That's just a guess on my part, and it pretty much assumes that the militaries of both countries advise their president and prime minister. We didn't do so well in 2006. Hezbollah has all manner of very sophisticated weaponry now that it didn't have then. Let's not even try that. So we'll see what happens there, but I found his remarks amazing in terms of what Zakaria allowed him to say. Let's see how much of it survives for the actual broadcast of those remarks.
Ray, shifting the gear to the conflict in Ukraine, and here is an article in the website of AnyWar. .com. It says that Russia says it could combine with China if both face threat from the United States. And how do you find this article, and what's your take, what they're trying to say in your opinion?
Nima, this is a very significant article. It comes on the 11th of September. And it's quoting Maria Zakharova, the spokesperson for the Russian foreign minister. And she's talking about the two countries combining, as it says in the headline there, to respond to threats from the U.S. Now, we all know that the Russians and the Chinese brag about their strategic alliance having no ends. Distinctive in the term that they're all comprehensive. They do not describe it as a military alliance or a mutual defense alliance because they say that's restrictive. That's aimed at other countries. We don't want to aim this thing at other countries, but you could be assured that we're together in all kinds of strategic ways. This, in my view, and I've been following this for decades, okay? Actually, I've been following this as the Russians are Chinese were at each other's throats back in the 60s and 70s. This is unique. This is the foreign ministry spokesperson saying, wait a second now. We're together now. Now, the Americans say they're going to deploy these intermediate range ballistic missiles in Japan. They all did that exercises of them in Denmark, I think it was. This is not going to go unanswered because we're together now. What else does she say? Yeah, it's clear that both Russia and China will react to the emergence of additional missile threats, and the reaction will be far from being political, which has also been repeatedly confirmed by the two countries. Now, her comments came amid a large-scale Russian naval exercise, large-scale, what did she say here? Naval drills involving 90,000 personnel. Kind of an afterthought in Western media, huh? 90,000 personnel, worldwide Russian naval drill. Who participated in the Far East? The Chinese. Where did they participate? Well, they sent ships and 15 aircraft and so forth. So they're together, okay? Now, she finishes up by reminding people of their rhetoric, their position. It's Westphalia. We don't have alliances against other countries so that, they're our enemies. This is a defensive position, Zakaria says. This is not an initiative to target other countries, but if an aggressive policy of attack is being implemented against us, like the two of us, from one center, why don't we combine our potential and give it an appropriate rebuff? Now, appropriate rebuff used to be решительный отпор. Okay, that was the worst thing you could say. That's what the Russians and Chinese were, the Russians were saying about the Chinese back in the 60s and the 70s. So an отпор, a rebuff is about as strong as you can get. But this is the first time that the Russian foreign ministry is saying, look, we have an alliance with China now. And if new missiles come into, they're going to be facing us both. We, two of us. So as I've said on this program before, it's the tectonic shift in the relationship of countries in this world. It's two against one. And I think that the dunderheads running U.S. foreign policy, I'm thinking not only of Blinken, but of Sullivan, his younger associate there. Sullivan went to China 4 weeks ago. Most people say he went to scold them for being nasty to people in Xinjiang. I think he went to sound them out. Can we play off you guys against the Russians? Is there any holes that we could exploit? Because we got a problem in Ukraine. I think it got a complete nyet, or Chinese equivalent, from the top Chinese leaders. So maybe he'll understand here that it's not so simple. If they put these kinds of missiles in Germany, as they're supposed to do in 2 years, will they face problems in the South China Sea, East China Sea, Taiwan Straits? Well, right now, they've been warned that they will. And I'm sort of, every now and then you can sort of pat yourself on the back figuratively, because I've been saying since the special military operation started that the Chinese were in this full bore, that they were supporting it. And that was pretty clear, because when Putin went up to China on the 4th of February to launch the Winter Olympics, he got the nihil obstat. Nothing stands in the way of you doing that. Just wait until the Olympics are over, please. So they were over the 20th, 21st, 22nd, 24th was when the Russians went into Ukraine. So very clear to me from the beginning that the U.S. has bitten off more than it can chew, and it takes years for this to play out. But now we have an express admission by the foreign ministry. Now, another point to make here, when did she say this? She said that on September 11th. Now, you have to put this sort of in context, and I've done a chronology of how things went down in Ukraine during the early part of September. If you have a couple minutes, I'd like to run through the high points of that. Okay. So banged it out here in my, I was going to say typewriter. That's so old fashioned, right? I have a word processor now. Okay. So Blinken and the Brit, I guess Lamy, were traveling all over Europe, talking to Zelensky, among others, saying, "Oh, we understand you need long-range missiles. You need authorization for us to deliver your storm shadow missiles and so forth." So that's pretty much, you know, your prime minister is going to visit to Washington on the 13th, Friday the 13th, okay? So we're prepared for that. So what happens? Zelensky talks to Fareed Zakaria, same fellow that we talked about before, okay? And it was really interesting. He's appealing for permission to use these things, but he's also saying, you know, the Russians have 12 artillery shells for every one that we have. And they have destroyed 80% of our electrical grid, 80%. Now, we think that's exaggerated, but not by much, okay? Why would he exaggerate? Well, because he wanted to tell Fareed and everybody how much help they need, how much they need to have these missiles, okay? So that was on the 8th. Moscow Times, the newspaper in Moscow, on the 11th says, oh, it looks like this decision has already been approved. Looks like the permission to fire these missiles well into Russia has been approved. And on the same day, David Sanger of the New York Times, who's the correspondent most closely in touch with the CIA and others, he says the same thing. He and two other very high-rated, highly accomplished journalists. Okay, then, and then only, does Zakaria speak out. And what is she saying? Look, you're trying to put similar missiles in Japan and aim at China. China realized that we're in this together. And I read you what else she said. This is big. This is probably the biggest point in this chronology. Next day, what does Putin say? Look, you authorized that. There's war between Russia and NATO. Wow. Very direct, very poised, sort of off the cuff in the middle of a driveway somewhere. But he says it. So what happens? Now, he says that about, maybe 12 o'clock noon Russian time. And the Pentagon has about 8 hours to figure out how to react. But what do they say? Their spokesman, Pat Ryder, general, two-star general, says, look, as Secretary Austin said in Rammstein a week ago, Ukraine has enough weapons. They need to use them. There's no silver bullet here. And besides, the Russians have moved a lot of their essential facilities well out of range of the storm shadow. The Ukrainians should use the weapons we already gave them, and they should use them to enhance the prospects of negotiations. Whoa! This is the Pentagon spokesman, knowing that Blinken all the while is trying to get Biden to approve this thing, because after all, the next day, Starmer arrives from Britain. So, on that same day, Nebenzia at the UN says, look, you heard what Putin said. Please don't forget that this is a challenge for against a nuclear-armed nation. Now, that's big, of course, that's for obvious reasons. This is the first time, I remind your listeners here, this is the first time since the Cuban Missile Crisis that one nuclear-armed nation challenged another openly, openly proxy war, but we know who's running that war, okay? So Nebenzia is at the UN, the Russian ambassador, is reminding people, not only are we at loggerheads, but please remember what Putin said. This would mean war against NATO, Russia and NATO, and it would be involved nuclear armed countries. So what happens? Well, an hour later, John Kirby, we call him Baghdad Bob, the Baghdad Bob of the U.S. Security Council. But he's the spokesman for the White House on strategic or military affairs. And he says, look, there's going to be no announcement of any approval of this today. We're going to be talking about it, but there'll be no announcement, okay? And then, of course, Starmer comes. Kirby says that 11:45 in the morning. Okay, Starmer comes about 3 or 4 o'clock. And if he didn't know what's up by then, his people are not listening to people like Pat Ryder of the Pentagon or John Kirby. So he had to know, but it was still a shock to him, apparently. And you saw the president acting in a very, very acrid way. He was so discombobled. Clearly, he was highly disappointed that the Pentagon made him face his favorite guy, Blinken, down because they were afraid that this would lead to war. In other words, what Kirby said explicitly was, we take what the Russians say seriously. Kirby, White House spokesman. 2 hours later, at the meeting with Starmer, a press person asked Biden, what do you think of what Putin said yesterday? And I don't care what Putin says. So thank God somebody else was running the government, at least on Friday the 13th, and we escaped. We escaped what could have been, you know, let me go on record here. I don't think the Russians are going to start firing nuclear weapons, even if this was approved. I mean, it is the fact that these Storm Shadow missiles have a range of about 300 kilometers. That's far short of Moscow. These would be pinpricks, okay? But Putin had finally decided, with the invasion of Kursk and with other embarrassing things happening, reverses, clear reverses that the Russians had been embarrassed by, that he had to put his foot down. This was a good juncture for him to do that. So that's what happened on the 12th. And then on the 13th, Putin spoke out. Now, it's not over. David Ignatius in the Washington Post, who was really a spokesperson for the CIA and for the administration, he said, you know, it's bloodletting in Ukraine. My God, you know, the business about supporting Ukraine for as long as it takes, that's irrelevant now. So, well, that was it, Lima. I'm reading along, I say, oh my God, even David Donatius is saying the bloodletting is such, and you know, we have so we have to escalate. Hello. So that's just my way of saying that the David Ignatius is of the world, and he's backed by all kinds of pundits and serious senior people in the State Department now and elsewhere. They're still at it. And the last thing I'll mention is that Peskov, when he was asked about Ignatius and all these other people still really pushing for this, he says, look, President Putin is very, very deliberate. Okay, he doesn't make decisions capriciously. He didn't say President Putin is satisfied that somebody finally listened to him, that somebody finally took him seriously, as Kirby said explicitly, right? But he said, Peskov, his spokesman, said, look, he's very, very deliberate. Deliberate. You know what deliberate means, says Kirby. And then somebody says, how about this Sergei Karaganov? he's the distinguished thinker in the Russian defense. And he's always been urging preemptive nuclear strikes and stuff. You know, he's still at it. Even Putin let him interview him a couple months ago. So Peskov, Putin's spokesman, is asked, what about Karaganov? He's, oh, yeah, well, we know about Karaganov. We entertain all manner of opinions and everything, but just don't forget, Putin is very, very deliberate. Last thing I'll just say here is that there'd been so much stuff having to do with Putin threatening nuclear war. In other words, his statement on the 12th that NATO and Russia would be at war was interpreted as threatening nukes. Well, Lavrov, at about this time, 2 or 3 days after this all went down, went on record saying, look, that's a misinterpretation of what Putin said. He didn't threaten a nuclear war. We got all manner of other ways to retaliate. And in fact, they do. As a matter of fact, they don't advertise it, but they have hypersonic missiles that we don't have. They have ways of evading Ukraine's defenses in our own when needed. And so what Lavrov is saying is, look, you keep saying that that Russia is threatening nuclear war. We're not. We're just saying, look, this is a red line for us, and sotto voce. We're really glad that this time you recognize that as a red line. Last thing here, is this permanent? A lot of my colleagues have been emphasizing the fact that Biden changes his mind left and right. Every one of these little red lines that the U.S. set for itself has been violated. So they're completely right. I'm only talking about what went down from early September until the 13th, when the U.S. acquiesced in recognizing that they needed to take Putin seriously, what he said the day before on the 12th. And so I can't guarantee that when Zelensky sidles up to Biden this week, Zelensky's in town and he's in New York right now, but when they get together, will he persuade Biden to change his mind? I don't know. I mean, Biden is not altogether with it. We saw him 2 days ago when he forgot to introduce the Indian Prime Minister. I mean, like the Indian Prime Minister didn't know.
Who's next?
Yeah, who's next? Anyhow, so, I mean, this should be ludicrous, but it's not. Because if you're looking on at this, and as you know, I try to put myself in the shoes of some of Russian leaders, they have to be on razor's edge, for God's sake. The U.S. military, well, they prevail in this one instance, but they're trained to salute and to do what they're told, to do what they're ordered, right? So when Putin jocularly said half a year ago, we like Biden, we think he's the best candidate because he's predictable. He's predictable. A pretty big slap at the Trump. Trump said, I don't want to be embarrassed or what, you know? That's what he said. Well, I mean, that's so clear. I mean, it's so logical. He's predictable. And Biden called him a terrorist or an evil guy again. And a Russian reporter goes up to Putin and says, well, what do you think about Biden now? and Putin says, just like I told you, he's predictable. And then, of course, jocularly out in the Far East, he says, now, you know, Biden, who was our guy, told us to support Harris. And so we're supporting her full-throated. And it looks like she's going to win because she has an infectious laugh. Now, that was enough to do it for the whole audience there. The U.S. press didn't get it. Now, finally, Peskov, his spokesman, has said, you know, he's just kidding around, okay? He's just kidding around. But this is nothing to kid around about, for God's sake. We have 6 more weeks before the election and then 2 more months with Biden in charge. So I think we can breathe a little easier given what the White House finally decided to do, overruling Blinken. And Blinken, I'd just say, is really pretty vulnerable now because he was clearly in violation of all kinds of U.S. law in providing military aid to Israel after it was clear Israel was creating war crimes or using it in an unauthorized way. Now we have investigations that have come forth. And of course, this is why many State Department high officials quit. They said there are laws prohibiting this. And Biden, Blinken is completely ignoring these laws. That's illegal. We can't work for an institution that does illegal things. We quit. Now, let me just go back a ways. So some of your viewers may know back in Iran-Contra, it's complicated. I won't try to explain it. But after it was all over, when the U.S. was doing illegal things with Colin Powell and Secretary of Defense Weinberger signing off on giving weapons to their various people in the far in the Middle East, including Iran, okay? Secretary Shultz, a good guy. I used to brief him every morning, every other morning when we were in a team. He came before the appropriate congressional committee headed by a man named Dave Obey, okay, from Wisconsin, really smart guy, okay? So he says, now, Mr. Shultz, we want to ask you about this playing fast and loose with the Export Control Act, okay? And Shultz, uncharacteristically, thinks he can play a game with Obey, and he says, now, Mr. Obey, I think, and I think you'll agree, that the Americans are just sick, sick and tired of hearing about Iran-Contra. And so Obi says, Secretary Shultz, let me remind you that I took a solemn pledge to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and I didn't say until I got tired. Okay. Now, there are very few congresspeople left that have that kind of integrity. And so the other part of this equation is that Blinken got away with this because no one gave him the adequate supervision in Congress. These are congressional laws. They need to be enforced. Congress is so supine now that you hardly know that Blinken can run right over them. And when you can be run over by a guy like Blinken, you're not doing much. So it's a little editorial on that's important though, and it's coming to people. Blinken should be held accountable for this clear violation of law, not to mention all the other kinds of things of trying to get us into a war with Russia, which I think he doesn't realize how momentous that would be. So in this case, thank goodness, he was overruled. Let's hope that he, as Netanyahu's lawyer, is again overruled and that the military can talk some sense into Biden, even though Biden doesn't want to hear it.
Hey, there is a new article in the Bloomberg. It says that just forget about Zelensky's victory plan. And it seems that they're trying to push for talks with Putin and Russia. Do you think that it's a concept within the NATO allies, or they're really thinking of it to do it in the near future?
Nima, I think NATO is hopelessly divided between the Poles and the Baltics and maybe a few others, and old Europe, as Secretary Rumsfeld would call it. So I don't see any cohesive approach on the part of Europe. Now, with respect to the U.S., there are increasing indications that Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal, other major newspapers know that Ukraine has lost. That is not hyperbole. Ukraine has lost the war on the Eastern Front, and it's just a matter of weeks before Russian forces could go to the Dnieper River. So they politically are focused on the next 6 weeks, what happens before the election. Now, I've taken an informal survey here in my neighborhood, and I've taken a look at it. Who are you going to vote for? Trump. Who are you going to vote for? Trump. How about you? Trump. Why? Because it's going to end the wars. It's going to end the war in Ukraine. War. Now, I'm no domestic political analyst, but that's a little sampling here right in my neighborhood, which is fairly progressive otherwise. So will Trump be able to play this card that he alone can end this war? I don't know. The reason I mention that is because if it appears that Harris is dead set against this kind of thing, and he's able to make her out as the war candidate, endless war, more, then I don't know, maybe that would have a certain resonance enough to let Trump win again. I mean, as you know, I hold no grief for Trump, but these things play out that way. And so in answer to your question, it's a long way to say, yeah, I think there are people in our administration that would say, well, for God's sake, let's make an appearance of reasonableness and a willingness to talk this thing through before the election so that we can at least deprive Trump of this high card that he has and say, I'm not going to end the thing right away. I mean, Putin he's amazed at what Trump is saying, and he and his spokesman people say, well, that's really interesting. We don't know how he's going to do that. They're really interested in how he's going to do that, right? But Americans are not all that well informed, and many of them could fall for this pretense that Trump and Trump alone can end this endless mess.
Ray, you talk about Trump and his policy if he wins. Do you find it, in your opinion, from what we've seen so far from his first term in office, and can we understand what he's going to do if he wins? Because it doesn't seem that this case of Ukraine would be that easy to handle on his part. And nobody knows who's going to be in his administration, what would be his policy, and who's going to run the administration. At the end of the day, he can be just surrounded by these people like Bolton and all the Pompeo and the new figures, and nobody knows who are these people that are going to get to the administration. But I don't see, Ray, when I look at his first term, I don't see that he's going to be able to do anything. That's why I do believe that Putin totally understands that. And that's why he's not saying that, hey, let's go with Kamala, because it doesn't seem that it doesn't make any sort of sense for Russians or even for Chinese, because this is a basic policy that comes from the roots of Washington's. It's not about Washington, not about any sort of president in power, in office in Washington.
Well, you're right. It's the military-industrial complex that's running things. We've seen direct manifestations of that. Even the latest tranche of military aid, $60 billion, if memory serves, that was approved by the Senate back last fall and not approved by the House until many months later into this year. I watched that Senate hearing where they were saying we need to approve this, okay? And every one of those senators made a big point of saying, now look, this is not giving away money to Ukraine. This is putting money into industrial, military industrial edifices here, industrial things, and more jobs. And in my district, there are more jobs and more. Every one of them, except Chris von Holland from Maryland, said precisely, I couldn't believe it. It was so obviously catering to the military-industrial complex, because that's the truth. That money goes to these profiteers on war, okay? So that was out then, and not many people watched that whole thing. I was amazed that I could stay still, but I just So that's really at the bottom of this. Putin understands that. He has said that in some of his speeches. He's also said that foreign policy is really a function of domestic politics in the United States. Now, I kind of knew that from studying graduate school, but I didn't really know it in an experiential way, in a tactile way. And it is really a function of the what I call the Mickey Mat. Now, I won't go into that right now. So, yeah, so when we look at the Trump administration number two, it's sort of like a bad movie, isn't it? Trump returns, the return of Trump. Now, what I will say here is that Trump has no excuse this time to being completely unwise to Washington. Okay. And I would just say, remind people that when he won, despite all the efforts of not only the Democrats, but the FBI, the CIA, the Department of Justice, the press, all of them tried to have Hillary win. And they did extra legal things to assist that. They lost. He won. So what happens? Okay. He won in November of 2016. Now it's December. Now it's January. January 3, 2017. Okay. Now who's the most accomplished, most experienced congressperson in our country? Chuck Schumer of New York. He was a representative for like 65 years, and there's a senator for 75 more. Okay, exaggerate, right? But he's like at the longest longevity. So he calls up Rachel Maddow. He says, "Hey, Rachel, I got something to say. Can I? I'm worried about the intelligence, how Trump is treating it. Okay, so yeah, come on over. So it's just a minute." But she says, "No, Chuck. You said something about intelligence. What do you mean?" He says, "Well, you know, Rachel, I thought that that Trump was a pretty smart guy, pretty rich guy from New York, you know, but he doesn't know anything about Washington. He's criticizing intelligence people. Can you believe it? Criticizing intelligence people. And they have 6 ways to Sunday to get back at you. He's a very foolish person." Now, Trump didn't get the message. And to his own regret, he started to try to play around with James Comey of the FBI, who had tried his damnedest to prevent him from becoming president, and then did his damnedest to prevent him from being an effective president. He and John Brennan and James Clapper, and all, they disemboweled him. They emasculated him. Okay, he couldn't do a damn thing. And the New York Times and everybody else cooperated. So, you know, the one thing I agree with what Trump says is that having a decent relationship with Russia is a good thing. You know, hello, one would think that's a good thing, right? Well, no, it's not a good thing, because then you don't have an enemy. Then you can't really have profiteering going to the military-industrial complex. It's really that simple. And then you can't have very effective intelligence agencies, or, you know, very strong, at least, intelligence agencies waging war here and there, bases all over the world. You know, this is the earmarks of empire. And the deep state is what keeps the empire going. So all I'm saying here is that Trump learned the hard way, okay? He tried to cajole the head of the FBI. "Look, you're going to be on my side, right? Oh, you're going to be." Actually, Comey was 6'8", you know, so Trump said, "Yeah, we can work together, right?" And Comey said, "Oh, sure." And he actually leaked sensitive documents talking to the president, you know, anyhow, it just was terrible. So the question is, here I'm Trump, right? And I know where the bodies are buried this time. I know the guys that screwed me in 2020. I know those 51 intelligence directors and deputy directors that said, Biden's son's laptop, Hunter's laptop, was a Russian intelligence disinformation operation. They put their names to that. They didn't have any evidence, but they said, I bore all the earmarks of the Russian. So I'm going to get those guys. Now, it's not that he's disguising this. He's saying he's going to get them. And his vice president, the candidate, is saying the same thing. Want to clean out the whole mess. Well, good luck, you know? I mean, in my heart of hearts, I would say, yeah, get them out of there. They shouldn't be able to cover up all the heinous things that they have been, that not only things against you, President or candidate Trump, but against what our country stands for, and particularly our human rights and the Fourth Amendment. So it's really hard to know how he's going to be able to go about doing this. If, you know, I don't favor Trump. I don't favor Harris. I think they're both deeply flawed people and would be subservient in the final analysis to the powers that be, the deep state. Now, the deep state is well explained by John Mearsheimer and Jeffrey Sachs in that wonderful interview they did a week ago. So I'm not going to try to do that. They do it better than I ever could, but it's not a foreign concept. 10 years ago, when I told my colleagues in the analytical ranks of the CIA, retired, I talked about the deep state, and they said, McGovern's gone off the deep. What do you mean the deep state? So sometimes the most intelligent people that are part of the deep state don't know they're in it, you know, but they are. And the way they react, of course, I call Trump derangement syndrome, because they bought into Russiagate. They bought into all this stuff that was made up. And of course, I'll just say one more time that Russiagate is reviving. It's like a vampire that you stick a wooden stake in, but unless you hold it there, it'll, you know, get up again, right? And that is really, really dangerous, because never have we been closer to war with Russia. Never. Never. And I've been around 85 years. I was born before World War II. We cooperated with Russia then. That's why the Nazis, well, the Russians pretty much bore the brunt of it. But we were allies, for God's sake. And who was it? John Kennedy, that wonderful American university speech, said, look, almost alone among major nations, our two countries, Russia and the United States of America, have never been at war with each other. Okay? Not a major war. So why does it have to be now? Well, you'd have to look at the people who are running our policy, what they believe, what they feel in terms of an entitlement, and how exceptional we are, and blah, blah, blah. Biden really believes that. I know he really believes that we're exceptional and indispensable. Why? Not only because he says it, but because he quotes Madeleine Albright, who coined the she coined the real word there. What was the other one I used? I had it in a second.
Indispensable.
Indispensable, yeah. So, you know, he quotes her and he says, you know, Madeleine Albright had it right, you know, indispensable. So, you know, this is the woman who, when asked if 500,000 Iraqi children below the age of 5 died because of our sanctions in the 90s, was that worth it? She said, yeah, that was worth it. We think that was worth it. So this is a strange concept. What I meant to say just a minute ago is that Biden told a small living room up there in New Hampshire, this goes back a year now, so it's not as though he puts it just in speeches. He appears to believe it. And that's why he's sort of benighted. And that's why people like Blinken, who may also believe it, for all I know, but they certainly act as though they believe it. And they're having a comeuppance. And with the BRICS starting now, in what, the 20th? No, in the middle of October. This is going to be a really big deal.
And if I'm not mistaken, it's 18th.
Yeah, right. Okay. So it's right in the middle of October and just a couple of weeks before our election. I think that that argues for more for Putin to be circumspect and not be very threatening in Ukraine or anywhere else. I don't know how it affects the Israelis. My God, they don't seem to be affected by anything. So, so those are the key, the election, then BRICS before the election. And then, of course, there's the transition in January. But as I keep reminding people, Biden's going to be around until January the 20th, for God's sake. And the Russians know that. Luckily, the Russians are not doing really, really warning type things like raising their alert level. And even U.S. spokespeople, military people have said, no, there's no indication that the alert status has been raised, DEFCON and all that kind of stuff. So let's hope that the whole thing can be tamped down. Good sign, as I try to emphasize during this talk, a good sign when the U.S. Reacted judiciously in taking Putin's words seriously. So let's hope that holds, and let's hope it kind of migrates over to Tel Aviv and our military and their military say, look, you can bomb the hell out of southern Lebanon, but don't ask us to go in there because we tried that once again. And that was just, 18 years ago. It didn't come out well then, and the arms are the teeth now. We're going to lose. And then I hope that they're up this to what Netanyahu says, because what he said, what he will say is, did you watch me before the U.S. Congress? Did you see how many times they got up and plugged? 58 times. Give me a break. If you guys get in trouble, if you get yellow and cowardly, well, the U.S. will come in and help you. Listen to me. I assure you they'll do it. Now, that's the danger. If he thinks that, and my God, if he's right, then we have a regional war in the Middle East just before the election or around the election time. God knows what that means.
Thank you so much, Ray, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
You're most welcome, Nima. Thanks for inviting me.